I'd like to start this episode with thanks for the kind and encouraging comments that I've received for John Brown today. I'm grateful for the positive words that I've received in various ways from John Brown Today listeners. You know, although I've been doing this podcast for a little while now, I'm still a bit mystified by social media and by some of the platforms that serve podcasters. In fact, one service that I recently learned about will track responses to your podcast and gather comments. Well, through this service, I found several other comments that were very encouraging and thoughtful. And so again, I'd like to thank you if you have made a comment. As a matter of fact, one of the comments that I found sort of inspired this episode. Now, I won't mention the name of the person who made the comment, but his remarks were presented and expressed in a considerate and respectful manner, although his point of view is quite different from mine and was, well, quite critical of John Brown. So today, one of the things I'm going to do is respond to his comments, which were, again, thoughtfully framed, but under the question, why John Brown? So if he's listening, I want him to know that I greatly appreciate the considerate and kind approach of his dissent, and I will do my best to provide a thoughtful response. So why John Brown? That's a good question, and that's today's theme. From New York City, this is Louis A. DiCaro Jr., and this is John Brown Today. It's no secret many people dislike John Brown. So objections to Brown are something that biographers and students of the abolitionists like me have to get used to. I must admit, in my younger days, I could get polemical pretty quickly. But at the same time, most of the objections to Brown that I've heard or seen online are pretty lowbrow stuff. Sometimes neo-Confederates and other Southerners with some commitment to romancing the South, or some other right-wing troll. But other times, I suppose, the anti-Brown objections come from well-meaning, but I think miseducated people who have absorbed the worst presentations about Brown. Sometimes, but not always, these folks have views on race that I would find questionable as well. But some folks are just convinced that they know all that is necessary to know about John Brown, and you can't tell them differently. In fact, that's something that amazes me about many anti-Brown folks. They typically come off like they're experts, and they cannot be told anything. And I'm not speaking about the person I'm addressing this evening, but it is something that often happens. Years ago, I had an exchange via email with a very conservative Christian editor of a very conservative evangelical Christian magazine. It was very clear to me that his hostility toward John Brown was bundled with a set of right-wing ideas about society and history, and it was immediately clear that his opinion of Brown was decided and fixed, and that he considered Brown a reprobate, someone beyond any consideration. Now, this struck me as telling, since Christians are supposed to apply the golden rule. But with many right-wing evangelicals, they only apply the golden rule to famous preachers like Jonathan Edwards, who was a slaveholder who bought and sold human flesh. In that case, of course, then they say they're men of their time. But John Brown, well, to hell with him. So as far as that editor was concerned, he would not hear of it, no matter what facts I presented to him. So a lot of otherwise intelligent people can get this way when it comes to John Brown. I wonder why. Over the years, too, I've observed a kind of prejudice against Brown among academics, oftentimes historians of American history, particularly in this period. Now, the academy, particularly white academics, has been hostile toward Brown for many years, even decades. In the 20th century, many white academics presumed that Brown was insane, a murderer, and one of the unfortunate causes of the Civil War, a war, in their opinion, that should have been avoided. In the later 20th century, many academics, pulled by the currents of more contemporary problems, especially domestic and foreign terrorism, put aside the insanity notion of the 20th century and took to calling John Brown a terrorist. You remember Ken Chowder and his article, John Brown, the Father of American Terrorism, and all that nonsense? This flawed thesis got a lot of traction in the academy, too. In 2009, when the sesquicentennial of the Harper's Ferry raid was celebrated, perhaps the leading academic gathering in the nation prioritized, quote, revolutionary violence, end quote, as a way to remember Brown, and not without frequent references by the leading speakers to John Brown and terrorism. As far as the insanity thesis goes, no responsible historian today takes that argument seriously, although there are still efforts to suggest Brown was bipolar or that he suffered from some pedestrian form of mental illness, even if he was not, quote, crazy, end quote. Interestingly, perhaps the worst critics of John Brown have been the Civil War and Lincoln scholars. This certainly was true in the 20th century, and I'm currently working on a manuscript about Boyd Stutler, the great 20th century documentary scholar who did so much to preserve Brown's letters and who advised so many scholars, artists, students, and biographers of Brown, from the elderly Oswald Garrison Villard in the 1940s to Stephen B. Oates in the late 1960s. One thing that I've seen in combing through Stutler's correspondence over three decades, over three decades of his correspondence, is the low-key annoyance he showed after dealing with the leading so-called American history professors of Civil War history. Although he sustained a cordial rapport with notable figures like Allen Nevins, Paul Engle, and Lewis Filler, and others, Stutler privately observed, I think, with increasing disgust, how prejudiced the Academy was against John Brown. And he found this prejudice no more exhibited than among the Lincoln scholars. As he put it in 1949, quote, "Most Lincolnians draw their skirts aside when John Brown is mentioned," end quote. The mid-20th century was the heyday of Civil War and Lincoln studies, and Lincoln scholars seem always to have been the most eager to diminish Brown. I suspect the reason they do this is because they know how vulnerable Lincoln is in actuality when it comes to the problem of slavery, how he was one of the last to embrace abolition, and that he did so when it strengthened the cause of the Union, and when it was clear to him that he could not go further without embracing what the abolitionists had been saying for years. He even tried to use John Brown's idea about liberating and empowering enslaved people against the South in the latter phase of the war. At any rate, Lincolnians at best ignore Lincoln, and at worst they demean him every chance they get. There are exceptions, but for the most part, you can expect that the leading scholars of our time, whether they are Civil War scholars or academics focused on the antebellum era or Lincoln scholars, will give the impression they are vexed and troubled by Brown. He's just so darn troubling to them. In all fairness, though, it should be stated that not everyone who objects to Brown stands to be chastened, even if people like me disagree with them. Some folks genuinely don't get John Brown for one reason or another, and they're not so much hostile as unimpressed, and they're certainly more impressed by other historical figures. Although I always have questions about the outlook of people who dislike Brown, including the well-meaning types, it's only fair to admit that people are entitled to their opinions, that whatever objections they raised deserve a hearing, and ultimately, it is part of the human condition to see things differently and disagree. Of course, I'm not talking about the ones who have a base hostility and prejudice against John Brown, who manipulate information and find some need to denigrate him for problematic reasons. And there's a lot of folks like that, including scholars. Such people don't get any consideration from me. Still, there are others who scratch their heads when some of us go on and on about John Brown. They look at his life and they don't find him inspiring or instructive or even admirable. Sometimes it comes down to how they perceive his personality. You know, it's interesting. Many years ago, I had a long conversation with the late Edwin Cotter Jr., who was for many years the supervisor of the John Brown Farm at North Elba near Lake Placid, New York, where the abolitionist and his raiders are buried. Ed Cotter was a thoughtful guy, and he spent many years researching Brown's life, especially his life in Essex County, New York, and his involvement with the fledgling black community there, dubbed Timbuktu. At one point, when we were talking about the abolitionist's personality, Cotter told me that he wouldn't really want to meet John Brown. Now, I found that a strange sentiment coming from a John Brown enthusiast, for all intents and purposes. Of course, as a historian, I can imagine myself doing work on a figure I don't care for if it was required or conducive to greater understanding. But I could hardly devote years of my life and labor, like Ed Cotter did, to studying some figure without having some sense that this was a person who merited my attention and interest, and notwithstanding the subject's flaws, that he or she would be somebody I would like to meet and talk to if I could. It may be that Carter was trying to present, in the same tradition of Boyd Stutler, a sense of objectivity and, shall we say, scholarly indifference, which perhaps he thought rendered his opinions more reliable than those who both study and admire Brown. But I don't think the pretense of objectivity is very convincing, and I don't think aspirations to objectivity are nearly as important as honesty and integrity in our work. My admiration of Brown should not distort my work if I'm honest about the evidence and if I use the sources responsibly. I don't know what turned off Ed Carter about John Brown as a person, but I had to respect his right to feel that way, whether or not I agreed or even believed it. In fact, I'm thinking of another brilliant scholar whose work overlaps with the Brown story, and one time she told me something similar. She didn't really admire him, she told me. She didn't really care for him. But I know this particular scholar is fair, informed, and has a knowledgeable appreciation for Brown's context, based on her own research. So again, whether I agree or not, I have to acknowledge that she's entitled to her views. I sort of feel the same way about a listener who wrote his thoughts about John Brown. I didn't sense any malice or guile in what he wrote, and while I disagree with him, and I want to address his comments here, I respect the way he could compliment my efforts in the podcast and also show me that he had made a good faith effort to learn about Brown and understand him. He posed his objections in a thoughtful way, and he frames his objections by asking, as it were, why all this excitement about John Brown? Why John Brown? Why not someone else whom, from his perspective, might be worthier of our attention and enthusiastic invocations? His comments deserve some kind of response, and I'm going to do my best to do so in this podcast. First, his well-written comments deserve to be heard, and so I'm going to read what he wrote. Then, I will try to address his comments under various points. Perhaps I can change his mind on one or more points, but my hope is that my response can be constructive and useful, whether or not he agrees. The comments that I'm about to read are his. Really enjoying this podcast. Recently picked up a copy of Oates' biography of Brown while visiting Harper's Ferry. Upon finishing the book, I still wonder why the significance and fascination with John Brown. His religion, his Calvinism, and his Old Testament beliefs are intolerable. His children thought so. His raid on Harper's Ferry, absolutely irrational and doomed from the start, as Douglas warned him. Brown's egotism and monomaniacal behavior actually convinced him that his actions alone would lead to the conditions of violence necessary to overthrow slavery. The Civil War would have begun when it did without John Brown's raid, as the more menacing threat to the planter elite was the rise and consolidation of the Republican Party. Secessionism and war were practically inevitable. There had to be others who disdained slavery and envisioned an equal future. Why then John Brown? Well, first, let me tell this listener that I appreciate, again, your kind words about the podcast. That means a lot. Second, I respect that you read a reputable biography of Brown, the 1970 bio by the late Stephen B. Oates, To Purge This Land with Blood. You even bought the Oates biography while you were visiting Harper's Ferry in West Virginia, as I recall. This is all commendable, and it's appreciated, especially because you're willing to engage and reflect, which is what I would hope for as a biographer with an interest in educating people about this portion of our nation's history and about this man. Second, I get your point about not understanding the fascination with Brown. Let me tell you something you may find interesting. The first book about John Brown that I read was also the Oates biography. Now, I read it sometimes in 1988 or so when I was a doctoral student at New York University, and at the time I was preparing to do a doctoral dissertation on Malcolm X. And I was much more interested in Malcolm before and after I read the Oates biography. In fact, looking back, I remember asking a very similar question to myself, not so much questioning whether I approved of Brown like you, but I remember being underwhelmed a bit. So I finished the Oates bio with a kind of half-glass feeling about Brown. In fact, it would be almost a decade before I returned to the study of John Brown. And when I did, the book that reoriented me toward him was W.E.B. Du Bois's John Brown, 1909. This was because I reapproached Brown through a Black Studies perspective, actually, in some ways, through a Malcolmite perspective. But it was really through studying Black history, immersing myself in a Black perspective, and letting that kind of speak to my reading. And it was Du Bois's narrative that therefore inspired me. When I got to look at John Brown through Du Bois's reading of the history, I found it insightful and inspiring in a way that Stephen Oates's book definitely was not. The irony of this, of course, is that Oates's book was thought to be the definitive work on Brown in his generation, and that Oates was taking a fair and objective stance toward Brown in a time when there was a lot of anti-Brown thinking in the academy. So when I entered the study of Brown in the late 1990s, Oates's biography was upheld as the go-to book to understand Brown. Now, even though Oates's book was, for all intents and purposes, the last complete biography of Brown published in the 20th century, it was published in 1970, and my biography of Brown was the first published in the 21st century, 2002. My work, published along a religious life approach and released on an academic press, did not unseat Oates's reigning biography. Now, there's a number of reasons for that, perhaps because calling my book a religious life may have been discouraging or may have biased readers, but perhaps also because books published on academic presses are not given the attention that books published on the trade presses are, at least in terms of major news publications like the New York Times and so forth. Regardless, 3 years after my biography, the blockbuster on John Brown was the monumental cultural biography by David S. Reynolds, John Brown, Abolitionist, 2005, published by Alfred Knopf. Happily, Reynolds' bio blasted through the hard wall of anti-Brown hostility and in many respects set things right for the first time in years. Even the anti-Brown set in the Academy kind of lost their edge after Reynolds, even if they continued to spew nonsense about him. You know, the most recent example of that is Charles Poland's America's Good Terrorist, which I reviewed on this podcast, Season 2, Episode 2. From my point of view, I believe that had you read Reynolds's monumental biography of Brown instead of Oates's book, it's possible you may have come away with a different appreciation for Brown. Oates's work is an attempt at neutrality, but he lacks the cultural, religious, and political framework to present Brown in an appreciable way. It's like the difference between eating a cafeteria dinner with all the basic nutrients and eating a fine home-cooked meal that has both a rich flavor profile and a cultural context. So to you, my listener, who finds John Brown quite unappealing, I do wonder whether you simply got off on the wrong foot when studying his life. I'm not depreciating your objections. In fact, I will address them. But starting points do matter. Furthermore, I'm wondering whether the National Park Service folks recommended Oates to you as the best starting point. And if they did, that says a lot about where some of them are, even though they are professional so-called experts. I would never recommend Oates as the first biography of Brown to read. And in my opinion, the Oates book is a better reference work than a biography. But even as a reference work, I'd rather turn to Oswald Garrison Villard's 1910 bio or its 1943 revision. Even today, I find the Oates biography sterile and bland. And while it's interesting and well done in many respects, and he was a capable biographer in general, I tend to think that's pretty much the arc of his work. Years ago, I read his biography of Martin Luther King Jr., and his treatment of Malcolm X in that work, referentially, was very exterior and problematic. So I suspect you are in part a victim of Oates' inability to capture the facts and present an authentic sense of the man. Every biographer must do that, whatever else we do. We have to do what a sculptor does when he or she makes a statue of a famous person. We have to, with our own best and deepest sensibilities, recreate the person's image with both information and discernment, including some imagination and spirituality too. Mark Twain once wrote that it's impossible to write a biography, since at least a biography is only what he called the clothes and buttons of the man. Not sure I agree that a biography is only that, but respectfully, I think that's the problem with Oates's biography. He's provided mainly the clothes and buttons of John Brown. It's more information than meaning, and he just doesn't grab the spirit of the man. He doesn't grab John Brown's existential significance. That's what makes him quite in contrast to reading David Reynolds' biography or W.B. Du Bois' biography. And let me be presumptuous and say my biography, too, at least I'd like to hope, will give you a sense of the man re-presented. Now, be careful with Du Bois because for all of his lyrical and historical representation of Brown from a black man's perspective. He was very limited in his resources, and therefore he used a lot of secondary research that was available at the turn of the 20th century. And so he has a lot of flaws and inaccuracies in the book in terms of detail and information. So because of that, his book fails as a good historical reference work. But in terms of grasping the significance of the man, he does not fail in summoning Brown for putting a life back in those clothes and buttons, if you will. So, friendly critic, I'm suggesting you were not served well by reading Oates first. And perhaps, for all I know, you were contaminated by the commentary of a National Park Service guide. Now, I don't know that for a fact, but it's been years since I was down at Harper's Ferry. But I can tell you that when I was there for the sesquicentennial again in 2009, I intentionally listened in as one of the National Park staff explained John Brown to a foreign tourist, and I was appalled at the bias he was conveying. Still, you present objections, and in fairness, let me attempt to address them point by point. So, you write, quote, his religion, his Calvinism, and his Old Testament beliefs are intolerable. His children thought so, end quote. A couple of points need to be made here. As an instructor in theology and a historian with some experience in teaching church history and historical theology, as well as one who holds to a theology very similar to John Brown's theology, I should add, I do not think Stephen Oates understood the Reformed tradition. He didn't understand the Protestant Reformation. He didn't understand Calvinism. And I think one of the worst aspects of his work is the way he caricatures and demeans Brown's Protestant heritage and beliefs. That's part of the reason I wrote Fire from the Midst of You, A Religious Life of John Brown. I hadn't seen a single historian or biographer do justice to Brown's Calvinism, and many of them try to use it as a straw man to, quote, explain him, or particularly to explain him as an aberrant figure. Secondly, you say that his religious beliefs are intolerable. Well, okay, you're entitled to your opinion, but isn't that a subjective question? I do wish Oates would have studied John Calvin and the Puritans and the American Calvinists before he trivialized Brown's religious views. But perhaps part of the problem is, too, that you don't agree with Brown's biblicism, and that's very well for you if that's your position. But respectfully, just because you find his theology intolerable, or at least a caricature of it, doesn't make it so. And the fact that his children thought so, as you put it, doesn't really prove anything more than that they had differing beliefs, no? The Brown children, with but few exceptions, abandoned their religious upbringing and dissented from their father's religion. Some of the dissent was directed towards spiritualism. They became spiritualists like John Brown Jr. Others were probably just amateur skeptics who were influenced by the latest rejection of supernaturalism and biblical authority that was then being imported from liberal Protestant seminaries in Europe into the United States. But not all Brown's children thought his religious views were intolerable. Ruth Brown Thompson, his eldest daughter, and Sarah Brown, one of his younger children, were devout Christians who followed in their father's footsteps, including his very high view of the Bible as divinely inspired scripture. Regardless, children, especially as young adults, often reject parental views from politics to religion. All this is interesting, but none of this proves your contention that Brown's beliefs were intolerable. Personally, I think the whole Old Testament Christian notion about John Brown is simplistic, and it's problematic. In Brown's tradition, Christians believe the Hebrew text and the Greek text, what Christians call the Old and New Testaments, are sacred scripture, and that one reads the Hebrew scripture through the perspective of the New Testament, through the perspective of Christ and his apostles. There is a popular concept, especially in the academy, that I think is both actually Gnostic and perhaps even anti-Semitic, and that is that the God of the Hebrews is some angry, bellicose deity, and that the God of the New Testament is a loving God. That's actually a very Gnostic idea. It goes way back to the time of Marcion and the Gnostics of the second century. But no Christian worth his or her salt, including John Brown, reads the Bible in such a juxtaposition. Christians see God's love in the Hebrew text, as do the Jews, of course. And they also see God's wrath and judgment underlying the very basis of the New Testament. After all, no one talks more about hell than Jesus. John Brown drew his ethical imperatives from the whole Bible. And interestingly, when he was pronounced guilty in a Virginia court, he wasn't sure if the court Bible was both the Hebrew and the Greek Testaments. But his famous comments to the court were appeals to the New Testament, not the supposed angry Old Testament. God's love and wrath are constant themes throughout the Bible, as are God's love and his mercy. And John Brown believed that Bible, believed the whole text, and the fact that he wasn't a pacifist doesn't make him a so-called Old Testament Christian either. A lot of Christians from the time of Augustine in the 4th century were not pacifists. Then you write, John Brown's raid on Harper's Ferry was absolutely irrational and doomed from the start, as Douglas, that is Frederick Douglass, warned him. Again, I wonder what orientation toward the raid you were given at Harper's Ferry. Frankly, the Harper's Ferry raid is a historical challenge, but I think no matter what your thoughts are on the Harper's Ferry raid, to say that it was, quote, absolutely irrational and doomed from the start is very questionable. First, the idea of the raid cannot be ascertained for its rationality if one has not made every effort to discern from Brown's words and actions and the available historical witness what he actually intended at Harper's Ferry. Second, keep in mind that it was part of the argument of dismissing John Brown in the raid by Southerners, who said it was irrational, and by Republicans who were trying to dissociate themselves from John Brown in 1860, like Abraham Lincoln. They all said it was insane, even though, in fact, it wasn't. But as I've argued elsewhere on this podcast, where did you get your understanding of the raid? Can you differentiate the Southern press and politicians from the evidence? Have you weighed the specific reports of the New York Tribune's undercover reporter over against the reports in the New York Herald, which was a pro-slavery Democratic paper? Are you able to make such a definitive judgment of the raid? Or are you confusing Brown's failure with the efficacy of the plan? After all, just because something or someone fails doesn't mean their plan had no viability or rationality. Or is it easier to believe Brown was a kind of Don Quixote? So, no, I disagree with you. If one understands the difference between strategy and tactic, then I'm not sure you can be so confident the Harper's Ferry raid was irrational, as far as it being doomed from the start. Are you aware that that's more a theological statement than a historical one? How can any credible reading of the raid say it was doomed from the start when everything Brown planned worked out exactly as he expected? Except for his own delays, which was a tactical error, not a strategic one. Is it perhaps that you think you understand the raid and therefore you can dismiss it as a fool's errand? Do you have an understanding that it's a failed raid based on inception and strategy? Well, sincerely, I don't think you can prove that. So you appeal to Douglas's warning about Harper's Ferry being a steel trap. Well, with all due respect, we do not know that Douglas said that for sure. After all, he is the only one from the secret Chambersburg meeting with Brown in August 1859 that survived to write the story. And he definitely conflated the record of the raid and his own meetings, and there was more than one meeting with Brown prior to the raid. He also conveniently hid the disappointing role he played in the fall of 1859 by letting Brown down, by discouraging black men from actually following him. So, maybe Douglas told Brown the Harper's Ferry raid would be a steel trap in advance. Maybe he did. Douglas was very honest, although he still presented facts in a way to protect him after the fact. But even granting that Douglas did take the steel trap approach in warning Brown, are you aware that Douglas was actually wrong in what he said? You see, Douglas knew next to nothing about Harper's Ferry. John Brown was very well studied, not only of the Harper's Ferry armory, but of the other, and there were only two in 1859, other federal army, and that was in Springfield, Massachusetts. Brown knew how easy it would be to take Harper's Ferry, both the town and the armory, and he did it. He even held it until the U.S. Marines came for him a day and a half later. In fact, the only reason Harper's Ferry became Brown's point of defeat was because he overstayed. If he was trapped in Harper's Ferry, it was by his own obsessive, stubborn inclinations to cross every T and dot every I and get paperwork, yes, paperwork, signed in the process. In fact, the man was never more ridiculous than he was in tying himself down by his own proclivities at Harper's Ferry. Had he just walked out of town with his hostages at 7 o'clock in the morning on October 17th, the Marines would not have found him at Harper's Ferry. So respectfully, I disagree. You may believe the raid was irrational and doomed, but that's not a historical argument, and the evidence doesn't bear it out. Then you write, Brown's egotism and monomaniacal behavior actually convinced him that his actions alone would lead to the conditions of violence necessary to overthrow slavery. This is interesting. Was John Brown egotistical? Well, I'd have to agree that he had a great ego and that he was also imperious. But like most of us, we're not definitively one thing or one way. I've read recollections and reminiscences of Brown from contemporaries across the board, and I can say that people didn't remember him as egotistical in the way you're suggesting. In fact, we know that he was imperious because he himself admits to it in his autobiographical sketch, which means he was mindful of it and arguably was not always imperious. Did he have an ego? Of course he did. Did it get the best of him? Sometimes. But Brown was not just an egotist, and certainly there were others whose egos were far greater than Brown's, including Frederick Douglass, who was somewhat younger, far more famous, and probably liked the sound of his own voice as much as the ladies did. That doesn't make Douglass negative, but most so-called great men struggle with being great, being significant, and believing their work has ramifications beyond the immediate. You write he was monomaniacal. You do realize that is a 19th century term. That simply means one who is extreme in one conviction or belief, usually a belief that is controversial. And abolition was controversial to many whites who disliked slavery, but were not willing to shed blood to end it or to allow their sons and daughters to associate with black people. Why is it okay for Patrick Henry to be a monomaniac about the white man's liberty, but then a point of disadvantage for John Brown because he is extremely committed to black equality? You likewise write that Brown was convinced that his actions alone would lead to the conditions of violence necessary to overthrow slavery. Well, isn't that a peculiar charge? In 1859, do you think there were other conditions in general that might overthrow slavery? We had the Fugitive Slave Law in 1850 and the Dred Scott decision in 1857. Was slavery going to be overthrown apart from violence? No. And anyone who argues otherwise is not credible. So violence was the only way slavery would end, and the federal government was not willing to take the first step by using violence to end slavery. And remember, Lincoln's 1860 position was that the South could keep slavery. Then where was the violence going to come from to end slavery? And do you know of another plan? I mean, a boots-on-the-ground plan to overthrow slavery other than John Brown's plan? Of course you don't. So why is it a point of monomania and egotism that he thought he could effect change and undermine slavery by starting a South-wide movement that employed some violence? Even Lincoln eventually saw the wisdom in Brown's plan, and he wanted to use it. And could Brown or anyone else have known that the victory of the Union and the end of slavery was certain? Brown knew there might very well be a war after the 1860 election. He said as much. But how could he or anyone have known that would happen in 1865, standing where he was in 1859? Brown feared the South was going to secede and take 4 million people away in bondage, 4 million people away from the reach of the United States government in chains, and he wanted to stop that by doing something. Something. Why is that a point of contempt for you? Or is it simply because he failed? What if he had succeeded in destabilizing slavery and throwing the South into a panicked mayhem, with enslaved people disappearing and the economy of the South crashing for lack of order? I'd say it was a good idea, and the effort to do something between sheer insurrection and doing nothing at all was not the mind of an egotist. It was the mind of a hero. But again, that's my opinion. And not to put too fine a point on it, but I wouldn't say that Brown really wanted to, quote, overthrow slavery. As I've said, he wanted to destabilize its operations sufficiently to cause its functions, that is, its systemic operations, to cease. If you don't mind a metaphor, he didn't want to kill slavery. He wanted to give slavery a major heart attack. He didn't want a blunt insurrection, which really is servile war, like old Spartacus tried to do in ancient Rome. In such a war, slaves kill their masters and their masters' families. John Brown did not want to do that, for sure. He wanted to disable slavery throughout the South to create instability and economic insecurity that would overwhelm the South and throw the economy and the daily operations of slavery into a flux. You and many other folks need to understand you've been misinformed about Brown's objectives. It's not your fault. But that's how history has been written. While he did not rule out the use of violence, and he expected it to be necessary. He wanted an alternative to servile war. He wanted an armed version of the Underground Railroad that went into the South, and he wanted to extend it all the way, as James Redpath said, to the Gulf of Mexico. He only wanted to fight when it was necessary, but more so, he wanted to rely on small cadres hiding and withdrawing into the mountains and in outlying areas. If you read Oates' biography, you know Brown's final words. Don't just read the first part. I, John Brown, am now quite certain that the crimes of this guilty land will never be purged away but with blood. He wasn't saying he had tried to overthrow slavery with servile war. He was saying that, having failed, he now believed slavery would only end with broad-scale war, that God's judgment would prevail, and in this prognosis he was quite correct. But consider what he also wrote. I had, as I now think, vainly flattered myself that without very much bloodshed, it might be done. I hope you understand that this is how he described his intention. He wanted to try to undermine slavery without very much bloodshed. Now, finally, you conclude the Civil War would have begun when it did without John Brown's raid, as the more menacing threat to the planter elite was the rise and consolidation of the Republican Party and its containment strategy regarding slavery. You say by 1859, secessionism and war were practically inevitable. There had to be others who disdained slavery and envisioned an equal future. That's a good statement. In this, we mostly agree. In fact, I appreciate this observation because it's unfortunate that others have blamed Brown for starting the Civil War. But as you say, there were influences in the South, the elites, as you call them, who had been thinking of secession for years. The major proponents of secession were in Virginia and South Carolina, the brains and backbone of slavery. As you point out so correctly, it was the rise of the Republican Party and its moderate platform of containing slavery that drove the South to secession, not John Brown. Of course, Harper's Ferry irritated them, and they saw it as a precursor of Northern so-called aggression. You know how they like to talk about Northern aggression. But as the so-called Mason investigation proves from 1860, the pro-slavery Democrats did everything they could to connect Brown to the Republican Party, because that was the real enemy. And that was about as desperate attempt as Trump trying to find stolen votes. Now, I do not know if a historian would say the Civil War was inevitable. Again, I think saying something is inevitable is really a theological statement. It's not a historical one. But certainly, all the evidence shows that there was no wiggle room for slaveholders once Lincoln gets elected. They no longer dominate the nation in the White House, and they don't want to lose the ability to expand, which is what they really want. And so, they secede. It was highly likely in 1860 that secession would take place, and in retrospect, it is difficult to see anything else happening. As a matter of fact, this is precisely why Brown did what he did. He knew, like many others, that the South might react to a Republican victory in 1860, and that if they seceded, they would take millions of victims with them in slavery. You may be interested in a conversation that Brown had with the young journalist William Addison Phillips, which the latter recounted in an 1879 article. Now, this is what he wrote in the Atlantic Monthly about a meeting he had with Brown in Kansas in January 1859, about 9 months before the Harper's Ferry raid. I have endeavored to quote him, Phillips writes, but it's quite impossible to quote such a conversation accurately. And so he continues, I well remember all its vital essentials and its outlines. He, that is John Brown, had been more observant than he had credit for being. The whole powers of his mind, and they were great, had been given to one subject. He told me that a war was at that very moment contemplated in the cabinet of President Buchanan, that for years the army had been carefully arranged as far as it could be, on a basis of Southern power, that arms and the best of the troops were being concentrated so as to be under control of its interests if there was danger of having to surrender the government, that the Secretary of the Navy was then sending our vessels away on long cruises so that they would not be available, and that the Treasury would be beggared before it got into Northern hands. All this has a strangely prophetic look to me now, Phillips writes in 1879. Then it simply appeared incredible, or the dream and vagary of a man who had allowed one idea to carry him away. There's that monomania idea. I told him he surely was mistaken and had confounded everyday occurrences with treacherous designs. No, he said, and I remember this part distinctly. No, the war is not over. It is a treacherous lull before the storm. We are on the eve of one of the greatest wars in history, and I fear slavery will triumph, and there will be an end of all aspirations for human freedom. For my part, I drew my sword in Kansas when they attacked us, and I will never sheath it until the war is over. Our best people do not understand the danger. They are besotted. They have compromised so long that they think principles of right and wrong have no more any power on this earth. I think Phillips was honest here about recalling these words, and no historian or biographer has any reason to doubt that he has preserved Brown's sentiments and ideas, if not literally, then in substance. The point is that Brown saw war coming, and he wanted to undermine it by trying a plan that would destabilize slavery and perhaps even make it more difficult for the South to become unified in its secession. After all, not all the Confederate states left with the same immediacy and presumption that Virginia and South Carolina showed. Not all the slave states even seceded, for that matter. You also write, there had to be others who disdained slavery and envisioned an equal future. Of course there were. But you seem to be confusing the end of slavery with an equal future. Perhaps another reason you do not appreciate Brown is because you assume that people who dislike slavery believed in equality between whites and blacks. You would be well educated to know that perhaps the majority of free state whites rejected the idea of white and black equality, and this included Abraham Lincoln. The majority of free state settlers in Kansas rejected black equality. Many of the Union soldiers who went to war did not fight for black equality. So this is a reason why you should appreciate Brown, because he was among a minority of whites who really did believe in racial equality. He lived and died for his belief that people are made in God's image and are equal. This, dear listener, is something of an answer to your questions, and particularly your question, why John Brown? I hope it helps. Certainly, I'd encourage you to continue reading if you are of a mind to sincerely ask questions as you have done. But I would hope, at least, that in your view of history, you will recognize why others hold Brown up as a significant figure, a man unique in history, and subsequently inspiring generations of people who are struggling for freedom across continents. But rather than closing with my own comments, let me close with the words of Frederick Douglass, since you quoted him as well. Now, Douglass knew Brown as a man and had observed him for well over a decade. And these words are taken from an autograph that actually sold on auction some years back. I couldn't afford to buy it, but I saw it online, and it represents how Douglass actually thought of John Brown. Why John Brown? Well, as Frederick Douglass put it in 1883, John Brown saw slavery through no mist or cloud, but in a light of infinite brightness, which left no one of its 10,000 horrors concealed. Why John Brown? That's why. From New York City, this has been Louis A. DiCaro, Jr., and this was John Brown Today.